You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of April 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, the crisis in Ukraine deepens as NATO intensifies its presence in Eastern Europe.
We will have more planes in the air, more ships on the water, and more readiness on the land.
Anders Fogh Rasmussen there. We'll discuss the situation with Kathleen Burke and Matthew Jameson and ask just what Vladimir Putin's endgame is. Then we'll also hear why Saudi Arabia's spy chief has been pushed out. And it was supposed to be a good day for Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott.
An entirely unjustified smear. And frankly, I think you should withdraw that and apologise, because there is no evidence whatsoever for that.
We will find out why he wants journalists to raise the standards of their reporting in the country. Plus, forget the selfie. We hear about the important role that the painted self-portrait, the original self-portrait, has played throughout history.
The tradition of self-portraiture really starts in the Middle Ages, and then it gathers momentum in the Renaissance. And then in the last 40 years, it's taken a whole new great leap forward.
All that plus, we'll check in with our man in Madrid and review the week in British TV. We might even play some new music too. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. But before all of that, here's Bill Bingham with the latest news headlines from around the world.
Monocle 24 News. Around 300 people, mainly high school students, are still missing after a ferry sank off the southwest coast of South Korea. The rescue operation, involving dozens of boats and helicopters and the US Navy, has continued through the night. At least four people have died after the ferry, the Seawall, carrying 429 passengers and 30 crew, sank in calm waters 12 miles away from land on its way to the southern island of Jeju. According to South Korean newspapers, the final death toll could be in the hundreds, making it the worst maritime disaster in the country in decades. There's no indication yet what caused the sinking, but witnesses say they heard an impact before the ship keeled over and sank. Ukrainian troops are reported to have entered the eastern town of Kramatorsk as part of an operation to recapture areas seized by anti-government separatists. The Ukrainian Defense Ministry says six armored personnel carriers have been captured by pro-Russian militants. Meanwhile, NATO is increasing military deployments in member states bordering Russia. NATO's Supreme Allied Commander Europe, US Air Force General Philip Breedlove, says the measures should not be seen as aggressive.
I think it's going to be very straightforward to see them as defensive in nature. They are designed to assure our allies. And so I think that in any case, it's always a chance that you run that something might be misinterpreted. But we specifically design these measures to assure our allies only and to be clearly seen as defensive in nature.
But U.S. Republican Senator John McCain, who's on a visit to Lithuania, says Ukraine's troops should be given more weapons.
It's my opinion we should be providing defensive weapons, light weapons, body armor, night vision, jet fuel. There are many things that Ukrainians need right now as Vladimir Putin continues to violate their territorial integrity. What we have done so far is almost disgraceful, how little we have done. We have not done enough to assist Ukraine, and we need to do a lot more.
A woman Afghan member of parliament has been shot and wounded in the capital, Kabul. The attack happened shortly after several gunmen kidnapped a deputy minister in a separate incident. The two attacks, along with a spate of deadly violence in the capital in recent weeks, have raised questions about the ability of Afghan forces to maintain security after international troops withdraw from the country by the end of the year. The Taliban has threatened more violence as counting continues after the presidential and local elections at the start of the month. The Pakistani Taliban, the TTP, have announced they will not extend the ceasefire they began in March, effectively ending their truce with the government. A TTP spokesman said their decision was due to the government ignoring their demands, but that they remained committed to peace talks. The TTP pledged a month-long ceasefire on the 1st of March. It was later extended to the 10th of April. The government had also suspended airstrikes against militants. Nigerian military personnel have joined the search for at least 100 teenage girls abducted from a school in the remote northeast of the country. It's thought Boko Haram, a militant Islamist group whose name means Western education is forbidden, took them to a forest near the border with Cameroon. Officials say the Air Force, Army, police and local volunteers are all involved in the search. For years, Boko Haram has been waging a bloody armed campaign for an Islamic state in northern Nigeria. The mini submarine being used to find wreckage from the missing Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 is on its second mission to the bottom of the Indian Ocean. The US Navy's Bluefin 21 was recalled for a short time after developing a technical fault. Flight MH370 vanished en route from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing, with 239 people on board more than 5 weeks ago. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Bill Bingham, thank you very much indeed. 1806 here in London, 1306 in New York City. You're listening to Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. I'm with Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, and Matthew Jameson from the Royal United Services Institute. Welcome to you both. We're going to begin with our top story, and that's a continuing unrest in Ukraine. In a moment, we'll discuss with both Kathy and Matthew the latest developments. But first, here's Phil Hahn bringing us up to date in this report.
Tensions continue to rise in eastern Ukraine as forces loyal to Kiev move to take back military bases and buildings. But confusion was the word of the day, as it was unclear whether it was indeed Ukrainian or pro-Russian forces in charge. In the town of Kramatorsk, Ukraine said they had retaken an airfield and were in charge of the town, but videos showed a convoy of troops blocked by both civilians and separatist militias. All the while, helicopters and fighter jets passed above. Overnight in Donetsk, pro-Russian troops seized control of the mayor's office. And today in Brussels, NATO Secretary General Rasmussen said the alliance was stepping things up.
Today, we agreed on a package of further military measures to reinforce our collective defense and demonstrate the strength of Allied solidarity. We will have more planes in the air, more ships on the water, and more readiness on the land.
Russia's Vladimir Putin said the country was on the verge of civil war. It's a sentiment many Ukrainians now believe.
We don't recognize that government's authority, he says. We're normal people without arms. They came in on helicopters, shot at peaceful people. After all this, it's unlikely West will be friends with East.
Tomorrow, it's expected that four-way talks are due to take place in Geneva. The question is, though, what is Moscow's endgame? For Monocle, I'm Phil Hahn.
Well, Matthew Jameson, let's start with that question which Phil posed there. What is Moscow's endgame? Or is that an impossible question to answer at the moment?
I think it's becoming quite clear what Moscow's endgame is. It's obvious that President Putin has a vision for reconstituting some kind of entity which would take into account some of the former Soviet republics. He wants to expand. He wants to take these countries such as Ukraine and Belarus, maybe even Moldova and so on, back within a new Russian sphere of influence. And he has, of course, said in the past, Putin, that the collapse of the Soviet Union was a tragedy, and it was one of the greatest geopolitical disasters to befall not only Russia but the world. So it's quite clear, I think, that that's what the end game is in the Kremlin.
Cathy Burke, do you share that view that actually he wants to reconstitute the Soviet Union, just this time without communism?
If there's any one geopolitical question on which everyone has agreed, it is yes, that the Baltic states are gone. Not anything that's inside of NATO is gone, unless there's going to be a huge world war. But that leaves all the stands. It leaves Ukraine. It leaves Moldova. It leaves Belarus. I think Belarus is relatively safe because it is a nice dictatorship and is not challenging Moscow at all. So that's all right. Ukraine, as we all know, I myself will be very surprised if a chunk of the East isn't sliced off. It's hard to see what can stop it.
But is that really? I find it the reason I don't quite share either of your sort of certainty that this is what Putin wants or necessary what will absolutely happen, because I just can't see really. Whereas Crimea, one can understand the historical significance and what that meant, and certainly bringing countries back within the sphere of influence, certainly whether that's through a Eurasian Union or however loose that coalition is. But actually annexing part of a country like Ukraine and taking off, you know, the newly formed Donbass Republic, Matthew Jameson, surely that becomes far harder to do and leads to some sort of military situation.
Well, only if you have within the calculus that President Putin is formulating that there will be a military response. I think President Putin probably feels he's on a roll here. If you look at the situation over Crimea, really not much was done when that happened. The West sort of shouted and came louder and louder and said, you know, this is terrible, you must stop or there'll be terrible consequences. And there weren't really terrible consequences. There were a few travel bans and asset freezes. I think actually Putin probably can't believe his luck that he has found an international environment which is so permissive at the moment, which actually has a lack of robust resolution to ward off aggression, because there's this war fatigue in the United States and the Obama administration doesn't want to get entangled in any foreign adventures abroad. And the president's foreign policy is now seen to be a question of putting down these markers and red lines and shouting very loud and then really no follow through. So I think actually if there's any time now to do this, Putin has hit upon the most opportune time.
Cathy, I'll come to you in a moment, but Matthew, I just want to pick up on that. You know, you use the phrase, you know, the word permissive. I mean, what is it that you and you know, talk about the president's Obama's supposed weaknesses here? What are you proposing he does? You know, Ukraine's not part of NATO. Mm. You know, and you talk about war fatigue as if that's somehow a bad thing. I think most Americans would say, yeah, we don't really want to send troops to Ukraine.
Of course, but you see, unfortunately, whether or not they want to, they have treaty obligations. And I know Ukraine is not a member of NATO, but the fact of the matter is, it is a European country. And we Europeans have to take our collective security extremely seriously, especially in the centenary anniversary of the First World War. We have lived in Europe with this kind of behavior before, with aggressive states just coming in, totally flouting international law, totally flouting democratic wishes and land grabbing. We've seen it before in the 1930s. We don't want to go back to that kind of situation again. And therefore, it is extremely important that the Russians realize they cannot behave like this. If they do, their economy will face crippling sanctions. The sanctions, the type of sanctions that Iran has been under. They will be politically isolated, and also they will be confronted with a much more beefed up NATO presence in the areas that consist of NATO member states.
Cathy Burke, are you quite as, I hesitate to use the phrase gung-ho, but as forthright as Matthew is there?
I understand where he's coming from, as they say. I have profound difficulties with some of the argument. First of all, Ukraine is not necessarily part of Europe. Eastern Ukraine is part of Eurasia. It's a lot closer to China than it is to London, I think one might say. I hope no one checks my geography on that, but certainly I think you get my point. Secondly, it's no point threatening power if you don't have the power projection. NATO has made it clear they're not going to go romping into Ukraine. Therefore, militarily speaking, there is absolutely nothing to stop the Russians from doing so. So if you can't stop them militarily, how can you stop them? You can make life tough. The problem is making life tough. It'll take several years. It's taken 3 years for Iran to get to the situation where it's seriously negotiating.
This is also different, isn't it, Cathy? Sorry to interrupt. Mm-hmm. That in the terms of the impact that the Russian economy has on Britain, on France, on Germany, is very different from the minimal impact that the Iranian economy has.
Well, that's true. One rather nice thing that's come through in terms of the Russian control of energy to Ukraine is that energy from via Germany is now going to be, they're getting 1 billion cubic meters this month, which will a little bit at least fill in the chinks and help a bit to make up the amount that the Russians aren't getting. I return to my main to a point, though, is that the pressure on Putin, it's difficult. If you don't care about the economy as much as you care about geopolitics, that's not an issue. If you keep saying, oh, we're going to get the oligarchs, what does he do? He keeps a closer eye on the oligarchs. Khodorkovsky was a great friend and oligarch, and he ended up in prison and stripped of his wealth. The oligarchs will be very careful. I think the West is in a very difficult situation. It's made even worse by the fact that Europe and the United States can't get together on it.
Matthew, I want to ask about the Ukrainian government itself, because let's not just leave this all up to, you know, the European leaders and the American leaders. Why has there been such a failure of leadership amongst this new generation of Ukrainian leaders in Kiev to realise that there are some genuine issues amongst certain pockets of the population in eastern Ukraine? And obviously, you know, they knew more than perhaps we did, that perhaps Russia wouldn't be so happy just to allow things where they are. Why didn't, Yatsenyuk or any of the other leaders, you know, head to Donetsk, make a speech in Russian saying, we are one country, all united. I realise we haven't even been like that before. We've played each other off against each other. Enough is enough. This is a new Ukraine. You're all as much a part of it as I am.
Well, I think that probably part of the explanation lies in the lack of caliber and the poor quality of leadership in Ukraine. Because, of course, we must remember that actually, you know, politics in Ukraine and Ukrainian governance is actually very corrupt and incompetent. It's an immature, political democracy. They've only emerged since, you know, the early 90s after the Cold War. So they don't have, in my opinion, the strength of leadership and the vision and also the capabilities needed to rise to the occasion, because a lot of them are, as I say, corrupt. They're more interested in filling their own pockets, and they are not serving the people of Ukraine as they should in this hour of terrible need.
And Cathy, just finally on this section before we move on, do you see any glimmers of hope within the Ukrainian leadership at all, that there are the inspiring leaders or the people that could at least help to bring this country together?
Well, hope springs eternal. They're not coming through the international media, if they are there, I must say. I'm as unhappy or as Matthew has made clear that he is, that it's difficult to see a very happy outcome to this particular international difficulty.
Okay, on that note, we'll leave it there. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Steve Bloomfield, Kathleen Burke and Matthew Jameson. In a moment, we'll be discussing why Australia's Prime Minister lost his temper with the press and also looking back at the career of a very particular Saudi diplomat.
The beret is not just a French cliché, it's a cherished piece of heritage at risk of extinction. Monocle Films pays a visit to the last beret maker in France and meets an Irishman trying to revive this quintessentially French piece of headwear.
L'Olaire has now earned the label of Living Heritage Company, Entreprise de Patrimoine Vivant, a reward from the French government to salute a firm's excellence in keeping alive a unique tradition. As the last manufacturer of a product so deeply ingrained in French DNA, L'Olaire and its berets are worth fighting for.
Vive le Beret, premiering on Monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, my guests today, Kathy Burke and Matthew Jameson. We're going to turn our attention now to Saudi Arabia. Prince Bandar bin Sultan has been pushed aside as the head of the country's intelligence service amid concerns that he wasn't doing enough to bring down the Assad regime in Syria. Just months ago, he was quoted as saying that there would be a major shift away from the US because of their lack of action towards the conflict. Matthew Jameson, Prince Bandar bin Sultan is an incredibly influential figure, not just within Saudi Arabia, but within the US as well. This is a man who served as Saudi's ambassador to the US for 22 years, from the Reagan administration all the way through to halfway through Bush 2. And in that time, he was... Let's put it this way, quite pally-pally with pretty much everyone that counted.
Yes, indeed. I mean, his nickname was Bandar Bush, and he was seen to be very close to the Bush family. And as you say, he was a man who has reached across the decades at the very highest echelons of international politics. So it is curious that he has been, he resigned of his own volition.
He's been resigned.
Uh-huh. But I think what this signifies is that there has been, of course, a major sort of breach between the Saudis and the Americans, not only over Syria, but very much over Iran and Iranian policy. And I think perhaps maybe with his departure, you'll see the two of them, Saudi Arabia and America, coming closer together on Syria. And also, I think the Obama administration will be quite pleased to see him go because he was viewed as being actually too close to the former Bush outfit.
Kathy, it's as Matthew mentions there was this issue over, over America's developing relationship with Iran as America was trying to get Iran to the table over talks about their nuclear program and then making some concessions. And the Saudis were obviously very unhappy given the situation within the Middle East, where it's a pretty much a Saudi v Iran situation across so many different areas. Do you think that this will lead to a change in the way that the US and Saudi Arabia deal with things? Or is it actually that the Saudis themselves aren't happy with the way that Prince Bandar's been able to influence America?
Well, there's all sorts of components to this, as we all know. Yes, Bandar has been was very influential. The Saudi Arabian embassy was a great social center. As Matthew says, Bandar bin Sultan knew everyone, handed out cigars, handed out fine cognac, and so forth. And he had a great deal of influence, partly because Saudi Arabia had a great deal of influence because of the oil. It wasn't because they loved Bandar bin Sultan, although some did, but nevertheless, it was geopolitics. And one thing that has really struck is not only Iran, it's Egypt, that when the United States encouraged the fall of Mubarak,
reluctantly encouraged. I mean, at the end, perhaps they were willing to encourage it, but only when they saw which way the wind was blowing.
Who is watching the wind?
America. I think it would be a bit far to say that from the beginning they encouraged that revolution, because they were quite firmly behind Mubarak, weren't they?
Well, they were. I mean, in a sense, there's seldom just one American foreign policy, as we all know, and those, especially in the State Department, who encouraged the revolution, and those in defense ministry preferred to keep Mubarak. But the point is that when the Saudis saw that the U.S. was not going to support its long-term ally, they thought, if Mubarak goes, what's to keep us in our place? And that's very difficult. What's really interesting is the approach, feelers that have been going out from Saudi Arabia to Pakistan, which at the first doesn't seem very likely, but it's two things. First of all, Prime Minister Sharif spent most of the last decade in Saudi Arabia under their protection when he was turfed out of Pakistan. Secondly, if Saudi Arabia no longer feels entirely secure under the American military protection, Pakistan is a nuclear power. And there is clearly on continuing negotiations over whether, in fact, they might cuddle a bit more closely than they have done heretofore.
Matthew, it's very easy to look at a figure like Prince Bandar and think, well, look, establishment figure, maybe not, his departure, may be seen as a good thing. And yet, if actually a person who was a key link between the US and Saudi Arabia is no longer in any sort of position of prominence, and as Kathy says, Saudi is starting to make eyes at Pakistan, that's perhaps something that, although, as you say, the Obama administration may at first be happy that he's gone, may a little bit further down the line feel, if we had the steadying hand of the man we know.
Yes, I mean, as Kathleen said, there's so many different components to this. It's so interesting, and the different layers. One of the things I think that actually has maybe resulted in Prince Bandar sort of stepping aside is the worry, perhaps, in Saudi Arabia that the Syria policy has not been going very well, that Assad is still in power when they would have wanted him out a long time ago, and that he is getting the upper hand. And of course, this is worrisome for the Saudis from the point of view of blowback, because they are concerned that actually a lot of these radical jihadists that have gone off to fight in Syria will find their way back to Saudi Arabia, as was the case with Al-Qaeda from 2003 to 2006. And there has been a sort of power struggle between the interior minister, who has actually taken more of a role in the Syrian policy, and also in the issue of Al-Qaeda, and this power struggle between him and Prince Bandar. Prince Bandar has also not been terribly well. He's been out of the country a great deal. He's been ill at home. He didn't turn up for a meeting with David Cameron at Chequers over Syria policy. And as Woody Allen has said, 80% of life is turning up. So, there are many issues here. And so I think that the Americans, but I feel as though actually at the end of the day, the Americans from the Obama administration's point of view will probably be pleased to see him go. And it's no coincidence that this has happened very quickly after President Obama has recently met with King Abdullah.
No discussion about Saudi foreign policy, of course, is complete without a reference to Woody Allen. let's change tack just before the bottom of the hour to look at the fortunes of Australia's Prime Minister, Tony Abbott. He was in Western Sydney today to promote the city's second airport, announced a series of new infrastructure projects. But his rather good mood was dampened somewhat after the unexpected resignation of his party colleague, Barry O'Farrell, as Premier of the state of New South Wales. Abbott had hoped that a news conference would be about the new airport, but instead it turned to corruption, and one particular question about corruption caused a certain amount of anger.
We need to have decent standards in this country. We need to have decent standards from the media, if I may say so, as well as decent standards from politicians. Now, I've asked for questions on Badgerys Creek. We'll get on to the other subject, but on Badgerys Creek and today's road announcement, yes.
Tony Abbott there, doing his best not answer any sort of question that wasn't about the sorts of things he wanted to do. Kathy, is it a Do you think people like it when prime ministers attack the media? Is it like, are we a good, tasty target? Or do you think actually a lot of people think, well, hang on, why isn't he answering the question? And why does he get to say what's the right question to ask me?
Well, the problem there was in the part that, of course, you didn't have time to broadcast, was when a member of the media who were asking questions from the floor referred to something that had happened as corruption. And then he made her backtrack and expand a little bit more about what she actually meant. She was in a good media form. You propose with the assumption, meaning that someone is going there, your interlocutor is going to have to say something about it. Obviously, these people are all in the same situation, the same room. They enjoy batting back and forth. And Abbott has never been known as a shy flower. He is a ferocious mouth when he wants to be, and I don't think it did him any harm to have the lady journalist make a point.
Although it has been, Matthew Jameson, something of a pattern amongst within the Abbott administration of turning on the media when they don't like the question.
Oh, it's a classic tactic that's been deployed by politicians throughout the ages. You know, when you don't want to answer for certain things that have been going on, when you want to try to change a headline, or when you want, you know, to distract attention, you rip into the media. Of course, you know, it is a bit of an echo chamber because actually politicians and journalists are two sides of the same coin in many respects. They feed off each other. They exist in a symbiotic relationship where, you know, politicians need the media and the media need politicians. And so everybody wins at the end of the day at some stage.
Apart from perhaps the voters. Matthew Jameson from RUSI, Kathleen Burke from UCL, thank you both very much for joining us here on Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Ut London, tu var Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando.
London. London,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Don't worry, plenty still to come in the second half of Midori House. We'll be checking in with our man in Madrid to hear why Norman Foster is ditching plans for his foundation in the Spanish capital. We'll discuss what role the painted self-portrait has had through history, and we'll also review the week in TV. We may be radio, but we look at TV too. But before all that, here's Bill Bingham with the headlines.
Around 300 people, mainly high school students, are still missing after a ferry sank off the southwest coast of South Korea. The rescue operation involving dozens of boats and helicopters and the US Navy has continued throughout the night. At least four people have died after the ferry, the Seawall, carrying 429 passengers and 30 crew, sank in calm waters on its way to the southern island of Jeju. Ukrainian troops are reported to have entered the eastern town of Kramatorsk as part of an operation to recapture areas seized by anti-government separatists. The Ukrainian Defense Ministry says six armored personnel carriers have been captured by pro-Russian militants. Meanwhile, NATO is increasing military deployments in member states bordering Russia. A woman Afghan member of parliament has been shot and wounded in the capital, Kabul. The attack happened shortly after several gunmen kidnapped a deputy minister in a separate incident. The Pakistani Taliban, the TTP, have announced they'll not extend the ceasefire they began in March, effectively ending their truce with the government. A TTP spokesman said their decision was due to the government ignoring their demands, but that they remained committed to peace talks. Nigerian military personnel have joined the search for at least 100 teenage girls abducted from a school in the remote northeast of the country. It's thought Boko Haram have taken them to a forest near the border with Cameroon. The mini submarine being used to find wreckage from the missing Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 is on its second mission to the bottom of the Indian Ocean. The US Navy's Bluefin 21 was recalled for a short time after developing a technical fault. Those are the latest headlines here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Bill Bingham. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Time now for us to head to Madrid, where we've got a tale of tunnels, a tale about design, and also possibly, if I'm very, very lucky, a football story as well. Liam Aldous, hello.
Oh, yeah, I slipped that one in there just for you, Steve.
Excellent. Good. Well, we'll come on to that in a moment. But first of all, let's talk about the strange tale of the mayor of a town called Navalcarnero.
Yeah, we've covered quite a few stories of mayors with a bit of tunnel vision, but this this mayor takes the cake because he actually, well, apparently constructed a network of all these tunnels under his village in the effort to bring tourists to the town. So he's claiming that the tunnels have just been discovered, but some inspections from the municipal authorities have basically uncovered that they were just built in the last 10 years, and he's apparently spent about €1 million on building these tunnels, claiming that they're 300 years old, but that's not the case.
Hang on, so he's been marketing these as, look at our amazing historic tunnels that have been here for more than 300 years, and actually secretly he'd had them built himself.
Exactly, and he's claiming that he was just refurbishing them over all these years, and the trucks, there was apparently truck upon truck of rubble coming out, and one of the residents in a newspaper story was quoted as saying it's a bit too much rubble for just some restoration work. There was hundreds of truckloads of rubble coming out under the main square, and the problem now is that there's worries that the whole town is going to sink because there's cracks appearing in some of the historical structures, and this mayor had grand plans. You can't blame him for wanting to bring get some money back into his town, bring some tourists to this little village. But he might actually sink the town, not by just the debt, but the debt actually is about €250 million, which is, mind you, is another issue. But he might actually destroy the whole town in the process.
Right. And has this plan actually been, well, until it was discovered that it was perhaps not entirely accurate, the story, had it been successful? Had it encouraged people to, I mean, I realise they're not open yet, to think about going?
Well, that's yet to be proven. The tunnels are meant to be opened to the public this summer. So unless they don't collapse in the meantime, it could still bring some people there. But the municipal authorities, since their inspections, are threatening a fine of another million euros for basically going against the strict heritage regulations of constructing in the historical centre. So the news story might actually bring a lot of curious people just to see the tunnels, even though they're not historical. The fact that this mayor has just gone ahead and built his own tourist attraction, it will definitely bring a few people to the town, but maybe if there's a €1 million fine, maybe it's not worth it.
To turn to another plan that has gone awry, although this is in a slightly different sense, Norman Foster had been planning to establish headquarters of his foundation just up the road from Navalcarnero in Madrid, but that looks like that's not happening anymore.
No, it's been put on hold. It's been suspended because Norman Foster has a bit of a bee in his bonnet because the city council came back and rejected his plan, which he sneakily amended after it had been approved by the city council. Once again, it went awry with the heritage regulations of the building codes and what have you. Basically, the city council approved the plan, and then when it went to the final planning process, he changed the plan and they rejected it. And he's gotten so annoyed that he's said he's not going to build his foundation there anymore, and the city council is struggling to convince him to come back to the drawing board.
Now, is this one of those things where you think, actually, reading between the lines, they're all just posturing a little bit and they'll sort it out eventually, or is this final, do you think?
I don't know if it's final. Nothing's ever final. The stories here, especially when it involves bureaucracy, may go on forever. Norman Foster definitely does have a connection to Madrid. His wife, he's married to a Spanish woman, and he's got a long history with buildings in Madrid. So he definitely does have a connection to the city. I just think it depends on how the city council deals with the process, because they've also bungled the process. The regional government and the city council aren't really cooperating, so maybe if they join together and they can all kind of agree on a solution, we might actually see the foundation built.
Okay, well, let's hope so for Madrid's sake. Let's talk football then now. Although it's more about it is a bit more amusing than actual football. Valencia a lovely club, particularly if you don't want Barcelona and Real Madrid to win everything. They had some real glory years about 10 years ago, didn't they? Getting to the final of the Champions League, indeed winning La Liga. But they've had a tough time over the last 10 years and it's just got a little bit stranger.
Yeah, and a lot of it centres around this one of the former president of the club, Juan Bautista Soler, who was recently arrested just last week for allegedly trying to kidnap the other former president of the football club, which is not a real story that you hear often in the football world about former presidents trying to kidnap the other ones. But he's been released on bail. But the problem is both of them are neighbours, so they have a restraining order against each other. But the restraining order is only a 15-metre restraining order because they live so close to each other. So it's going to go through the courts. But basically it centres around a debt or a share deal, a multi-million euro share deal that went wrong, and Soler is very angry, and I don't know what he was trying to do by kidnapping the president, trying to get his the millions of euros under his mattress or something, but I'm sure this story will rear its head again.
And Valencia as a club has really been suffering in recent years, partly because of the debts that Soler built up.
Exactly. Soler will be remembered for building the new stadium, but also leaving a massive debt. And it's very interesting to point out that Soler was also a real estate businessman. So given the Valencia region's history with real estate, with corruption and dodgy deals, the whole thing smells very iffy.
Liam Aldous in Madrid. Thank you very much indeed, as ever. You're listening to Midori House. Up next, we'll be talking about the importance of self-portraits, not from now, not nowadays on cell phones, but from rather longer ago. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. Self-portraits are an inherent cultural tradition that date back from medieval times. They're a defining aspect of our confessional age. Just look at the selfie phenomenon. From the early myth of Narcissus to the confessional self-portraits of Michelangelo, a new book appropriately titled The Self-Portrait, A Cultural History, goes through that history of self-portraiture. The author, James Hall, spoke to our very own Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
The earliest self-portrait I discuss in the book is of a pot-bellied Egyptian sculptor standing next to his wife and feeling very proud of himself. So that's several thousand years ago. But I think the tradition of self-portraiture really starts in the Middle Ages, and then it gathers momentum in the Renaissance. And then in the last 40 years, it's taken a whole new great leap forward, and you find artists all over the place whose entire careers are based on a form of self-portraiture.
I would like to ask you something, James, about what you call in the book the medieval mirror craze. Can you explain to us what is that?
Well, traditionally, people have said that in around 1460, the Venetians invented crystal glass mirrors that were much better than the previous quality of glass. And the idea is that with the Renaissance, suddenly people can see themselves properly for the first time. And I say this is actually completely wrong, because people had had all sorts of other kinds of mirrors which were actually better quality than crystal glass and larger. For example, either polished steel mirrors, which carried on being used right into the 18th century. And in the 12th century, I say there's a medieval mirror craze. Everyone becomes fascinated by the science and symbolism of mirrors. So Dante, the greatest writer of the Middle Ages, he refers to mirrors over 30 times in his writings, and even in the Paradise section of the Divine Comedy, an experiment is proposed using three mirrors. And so they were actually much more interested in mirrors in the Middle Ages than they were later on in the Renaissance. And you find the first clusters of great self-portraits being produced in the 12th century.
And I mean, you mentioned the Renaissance. I mean, I have to say, because it's quite a visual book, which is beautiful because you can see actually the self-portraits. One of my favorites is this one in page 74 by Albrecht Dürer. And can you tell us, this is quite a beautiful self-portrait. He looks a bit like Jesus somehow, you know. Is this like in the Renaissance period? Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yes, it's dated 1500. And this is a classic self-portrait. He's looking straight out at us. It's virtually symmetrical, and the composition is based on images of Christ, but actually he's much more beautiful than Christ. Dürer was famous for his sense of style and the care he took over his hair, and if you look closely at the picture you can see almost the individual hairs, browns and golds and silvers. And so this is a self-portrait of the artist, both as another god and also as a man of extraordinary beauty and cultivation. There's a wonderful detail in it where he touches with his fingers his fur-lined robe, and it's incredibly sensuous.
Exactly. Even the coat, I mean, it's so realistic somehow, I have to say. I mean, I know it's could be a difficult question for you, but do you have like a favourite self-portrait in the book by any chance?
I think maybe one by Artemisia Gentileschi. She was the daughter of a painter called Orazio Gentileschi, who worked at the court of King Charles I in England in the early 17th century. And she was a phenomenon in her own time, because it was pretty unusual for a woman to paint, and not just paint, be an absolutely extraordinary painter. And this self-portrait is probably the most energetic self-portrait, both before and perhaps after. She's got her arms outstretched and she almost seems to be floating in front of the canvas. And I think this is because she's based her pose on that of Michelangelo's God on the Sistine ceiling when he's creating light and dark. And it's quite an extraordinary image.
When did you decide to write about the topic? I mean, were you kind of influenced about this? I mean, because everybody's talking about selfies, you know, the one that Obama took in Nelson Mandela's funeral, the one at the Oscars, you know, everybody's really talking about this topic. So why did you decide to write a book about this topic?
In my previous books, I've written chapters on self-portraits. So I've been thinking about it for a long time. I was a full-time newspaper critic, and it struck me as extraordinary, this phenomenon of the career self-portraitist, the Gilbert and Georges, the Tracy Emins, the Cindy Shermans, who they don't necessarily call their work self-portraiture, but they're in every single work they do, pretty much. And so it's something I've been thinking about for a long time. And then I decided, well, there simply wasn't a book that actually really went into detail about the history of self-portraiture. But another interesting facet, I think, is that self-portraiture amongst artists who you see in galleries probably peaked in the 1990s with Jeff Koons doing all his sculptures and photographs in flagrante with his then wife Cicciolina and Tracy Emin. And there's been a bit of a reaction against that. And then suddenly, 6 months before the book's published, the whole selfie thing comes on stream. And when I wrote the book and finished it in the beginning of last year, I hadn't actually heard of the term selfie. And I assume no one at Thames and Hudson, my publishers, had. Otherwise, they would have told me about it.
Good timing. That's all I can say.
Fantastic. I would never look a gift horse in the mouth, even though I am rather terrified at the prospect of spending the rest of my life being asked to judge selfie competitions, which I think could be a fate worse than death.
Yeah, he says that, James Hall, but I'm sure he's realised there's money in it. That's James Hall talking about his new book, The Self-Portrait, A Cultural History, speaking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Music now. These guys are from Brooklyn. They're called Lucius, and this is Turn It Around. Lucius from Brooklyn there with Turn It Around. Rather lovely, I think you'll agree. Lovely's not the right word, but you know what I mean. I really like it. It's Midori House. It is almost the end of the show. 1852 just came up to. It's Wednesday, so it's a TV review day. Jasper Rees from theartsdesk.com is with us. Jasper, hello. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you.
We're looking at British TV this month, and we've got we've got some serious stuff. We've also got a couple of really good, innovative comedies, innovative in their own special way. We'll get on to Rev in a moment. But first, The Trip to Italy, which is the long-awaited sequel to The Trip, which, let's face it, when they sort of explained what this was originally, it sounded as if it could be slightly self-indulgent. Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon, two well-known British comedians, as themselves, going to restaurants and eating and doing impressions. But
exactly.
It was amazing.
It was extremely funny. Just being versions of themselves and having fictional private lives. So Rob Brydon, who is a very well-known and extremely popular Welsh comedian, his wife was played by an actress. And in this series, Steve Coogan has a son who appears on Skype, who is, I presume, played by an actor. But this time they've gone to Italy and they're working their way down the peninsula. They started in Piedmont and they'll end up in Capri. And the format is pretty much the same. They go to restaurants, they sit and eat incredibly good food, which theoretically Rob Brydon is reviewing for The Observer. But they seem to have no interest in the food whatsoever, and the only thing they're really interested in doing is running through their favourite impersonations.
Let's hear a little bit of it.
The Observer wants us to do more restaurant reviews, this time in Italy. What do you think? Beautiful countryside, beautiful wine, beautiful women, beautiful food.
Aha!
Please don't, will you not, just not do
seriously?
That.
Please open you, open wide, open wide.
You shouldn't say open wide again like that. You gotta get that sound on the talk of his nose like that, dude.
What's that? I just said I love your sandals.
The Trip to Italy on BBC Two and BBC Two HD.
The one thing we didn't have there is any Michael Caine impressions. Tell me,
no,
the Michael Caine impressions are still there.
The Michael Caine impressions are very much still there because the car that they, it's queued up beautifully in the first episode because the car that they rent is, of course, a Mini. And needless to say, a Mini in Italy is a natural segue for them to do jousting with their Michael Caine impressions about blowing the bloody doors off from the Italian job.
But it's really hard right now not to do a Michael Caine impression.
Oh, go on.
Or a Rob Brydon doing Michael Caine impression. No, we're not going to go there. Now, the link between this and the next comedy we want to talk about, Rev, is that they... Well, you test the link and then we'll hear a bit of it.
The link between Rev and The Trip to Italy is they are both sitcoms that are directed by film directors. So, you know, if you think of a traditional British sitcom, you never know the name of the director, but the Trip to Italy is directed by Michael Winterbottom, who's made many films with Steve Coogan. And Rev is directed by Peter Cataneo, who made The Full Monty.
And Rev, the setup of, you know, Tom Hollander playing a rural parish vicar is...
I've got to stop you there. Urban parish vicar. There are many rural rev coms.
That's
there have
true,
been in the
yes.
past, you know, think of Father Ted or the Vicar of Dibley. But this one, the kind of unique selling point of this is a vicar who's kind of ankle deep in needles and the other detritus of the inner city.
But it's certainly not a Vicar of Dibley, is it?
Absolutely not. No, this most recent episode, which was on BBC Two on Sunday night, went into incredibly dark territory. Quite apart from the fact that there's been a suggestion of adultery and that his marriage might be breaking down. A character, the thing about Adam Smallbone, the Reverend Adam Smallbone, wonderfully played by Tom Hollander, is that he is constantly grappling with his conscience and constantly attempting to be a good man in a difficult world. And in this episode, someone who promised to come along and help with the accounts of the church, because the church, it being the Church of England, the church is horribly in debt to the tune of £60,000. And the accountant who came in turns out to be an ex-jailbird who's been imprisoned for downloading images of children. And so that is really dark stuff, and you would think you cannot make comedy out of this, but it's fantastically humane, and yet weirdly they find corners that they can be where they can be funny.
Indeed. And then just finally, let's talk briefly about Watermen, A Dirty Business, which is a new documentary series on the BBC.
It's in a great tradition of BBC documentaries where a camera crew goes to, follows a particular profession in the workplace. It's got wonderful characters. It's not really about the work itself. It's about the people who do the work. And water, I would have to say, is a euphemism for the stuff that they find themselves wading through most of the time in this show.
Yeah, I think they could have, I don't think they could have called it anything else, really, could they?
Right, you nearly went there.
No, I wasn't going to go there at all.
Slurry men, shall we say.
Yes, indeed. But, I mean, do they manage to actually make it? I mean, obviously they make, you know, it's a difficult premise, but they make it, you know, it's a fascinating documentary series, isn't it?
It is. It really is worth watching. And as I say, it's not worth watching because of the work they do, although that is tangentially fascinating. It's because, it's that old adage that everyone has a good story to tell. And these people are natural characters. I mean, as often happens in these documentaries, they've quite clearly been cast as being people who work well on telly. And they really do. It's well worth watching.
Jasper Rees from theartdesk.com. Thank you very much indeed for joining us on Midori House. That is that for today's edition. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Kathleen Burke and Matthew Jameson. The show was produced by Phil Hahn, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Sarah Fournier. Our studio manager was Bill Luty. The Entrepreneurs is up next. They'll meet a glove maker in Madrid. You don't want to miss that. The Monocle Daily is up at 2200 hours. We're back at the same time tomorrow. But from all of us here, I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.